We are having this morning over in the new fellowship hall, which is the wing to your right, a catered lunch. Tickets are $5 a plate, and I think you will probably find that it's the best bargain in town. What I really want to tell you is that in addition to those who have reserved places, I think we probably can accommodate another 20 or 25 people, and we would be delighted to have you stay, any of you who had not planned to do this, until those tickets are exhausted. And some of us will sit on chairs rather than at the nice tables if necessary. We would like to have you. I have never known how many people bother to check sermon titles, but if you did that this morning, you probably recognized the famous line from the book of Ruth that brides must have spoken thousands of times in wedding ceremonies: "Entreat me not to leave thee, for whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge," and so on. Language seldom heard anymore because wedding customs have changed, the verbs and the pronouns are old-fashioned, and the words don't fit. The bride is quite as likely to say, "Let's try to stay together in the same town if we can, but my work is in Chicago, and I hope you can find a job there." Somebody a few months ago, listening to some of our stories about weddings, asked if I'd be willing some Sunday morning to talk about the American way of tying the knot, about how much and how little things have changed, and about how importantly the church, despite the doomsayers of a few years ago, still gets involved with this particular peak moment in human life, a moment filled on most occasions with enormous tenderness, dignified and beautiful, on rare occasions giddy and gauche, but almost invariably of immense importance to at least two of the people involved. I decided, as a change of pace, to grant that request this morning, counting as I do from time to time on the creative listeners in this church to find, even in this kind of sermon, something worth saying from a pulpit. In the 60s, as you know, the formal wedding was thought to be on the road to extinction, dying like the dodo and the dinosaur. In their rebellion against established values, the children were living together without benefit of clerical pronouncement, or else just joining everybody else in a free-living communal clan. I remember reading about how the usual engagement rings and bridal showers, attendants and wedding gowns, reception parties and honeymoons were all passé. But as it turns out, the predictions were wrong. The children may be living together without benefit of clerical pronouncements, but after a while, they decide they would like to have the pronouncements and the wedding, and so off they troop to church. Mom's or Aunt Kate's or somebody's, since they often do not have one, and throw as big and traditional a wedding as their parents and grandparents did. It is true that for a while we had some rather bizarre weddings. Woodstockian gatherings, the sweet acrid smell of pot smoke, Mick Jagger and that wedding on a Big Sur cliff, where the bride and groom arrived on horseback, nude, And all the guests peeled off their jeans and tie-dyed shirts and whooped it up. But it never really caught on. The kids from Keokuk and Kankakee decided against forsaking the fig leaf and moved back toward the more traditional ceremonies. It has something to do, I suspect, with our need for ritual. Parades, Memorial Day speeches and flags, saying the Lord's Prayer in unison, taking communion, all those stabilizing moments that give life equilibrium and consistency and reassure us that we are in touch with something older than the present date on the calendar. Grace before meals. My folks did it with such predictable regularity, and I must confess I thought sometimes monotony, that I vowed to do it only on special occasions. And that's what we do, joining hands at holidays or when the children or beloved friends have driven in. It seems more meaningful to me that way, and yet I do confess that, monotonous or not, the mandatory pause before each meal may have just as much to commend it. So life is filled with ritual moments. Birthdays, anniversaries, graduations. We stage a public meeting, hold a ceremony, invite our guests to witness how it is that life moves from one stage to another. Rituals, of course, are always tied in with the kind of world one lives in. If a boy in Africa used to be thrown naked into the jungle and required to kill a lion to show how successfully he would be able to function in the tribe, the newlyweds in an American consumer society are properly involved with buying things and receiving things which others have bought for them. Whatever else weddings may be, they are big business, and our free enterprise system is as eager to promote traditional weddings as any couple or church could ever hope to be. If you haven't paid for one recently, here's a reminder of the opportunities a wedding offers to stabilize the economy. Toasters and teapots for the bridal shower, an engagement ring, wedding rings for bride and groom, gifts of jewelry and clothing for the attendants, the gorgeous wedding gown, the tuxes and gowns for groomsmen and bridesmaids, the rehearsal dinner, the wedding reception, the cost of musicians and ministers, of photographers and printers, of honeymoon travel. It's never hard to spot the people who are paying for all this. They have a kind of stricken look. The pressure people often feel to outdo some other wedding can be tough on those with limited resources. Unfortunately for them, it's hard to fool the expert wedding goers. They pretty well know what everything costs. I have seen somebody get a wedding invitation and run her fingers over the print to see if it's raised, because that shows hand engraving and sends a coded message about how expensive the ceremony will be and how nice a gift one needs to bring. It may be an odd sort of blessing that now, like so many other things in an ersatz society, the printing can be faked and you can hardly tell the difference. If I begin to make some of this sound unreal, that's because there are elements in weddings that have little connection with reality. I won't belabor the business of how the white wedding gown and veil were once promoted as symbols of virginal purity, an issue few ministers are likely to raise in prenuptial counseling. But the tradition hangs on anyway, and the gowns are so beautiful, nobody would wish to give them up, even for the third wedding. And I speak from recent experience. As for other realities, I see an ordinary-looking girl fly into church a couple of hours before the wedding, totally disheveled, hair in rollers, no makeup, and then somebody comes radiantly floating down the candle-lit and flower-strewn aisle, so beautiful that I wonder who came in to take that other girl's place. More glamorous, I suspect, than she will ever be again the rest of her life. And why not? Life ought to peak once or twice. As for the groom and groomsmen, for the most part, they resemble pleasant penguins. Necessary for the wedding, but certainly not the center of attention. How often have you ever seen a groom process grandly down the aisle to the altar? He sort of slips in inconspicuously through the side door, quietly ready to be there when the right moment comes. Let him and his groomsmen rent, beg, borrow, or steal their outfits. No one cares much. They get only a quick glance, mostly from their mothers. They are escorts, appendages to the princess and her ladies-in-waiting. I cannot imagine, for example, a groom saying this about himself, but I've heard it from more than one bride. I had always dreamed about being a beautiful bride for as long as I could remember. I just loved every single minute of it. And even though it was ridiculously expensive and there were months of aggravation, I would go through it again in a minute. It is, after all, the bride's moment. And after her, it is a moment relished especially by her mother and every other mother of a daughter who is likely someday to be doing the same thing. As a male member of a congregational church like ours says in Thornton Wilder's Our Town to a boy about to get married, "A man looks pretty small at a wedding, George. All those good women standing shoulder to shoulder, making sure that the knot's tied in a mighty public way." He understands that much that is good in life would dissolve without the insistence and determination of women who have the good sense to keep ceremony alive and to boost the economy at the same time. I do marvel sometimes that brides especially can survive the perfection and romanticism of the wedding. How can anything that follows measure up to such a high? When will she ever have so many people watching her with teary eyes and admiring glances, smoothing her train the moment it gets ruffled, treating her like a movie star on the night of the Academy Awards? I can understand the girl who said after her $20,000 wedding in a Phoenix hotel that took a year to plan, that when it was over and finished, so was she, and that she dropped for a time into a profound depression. Weddings in the Midwest are pretty tame compared to some that happen on the East and West Coast. There was the rich young woman who had her wedding at the Waldorf Astoria, and so much wanted it to be unique that she hired a live horse to dance the Blue Danube Waltz with its trainer. And because weddings are always a little unpredictable, the horse added some other unexpected touches to the evening. There was the middle-class family in Illinois who built a special knotty pine chapel, complete with stereo, in their backyard, only to tear it down immediately after the wedding. I have been able to avoid the more spectacular ceremonies, knowing when I would not be comfortable, as in times like this, the ones wanting to be married on skates at the roller rink, the ones wanting to be married at the top of a mountain in a snowstorm, on snow or water skis, the two amateur skydivers who jumped from a plane holding hands and were followed by a priest who married them where they landed. She, by the way, had white leather jump boots, a white crash helmet, and white satin overalls. I might have performed the ceremony for the Wichita couple who got married in the dining car of the Santa Fe Scout, but not the pair who said their vows underwater in wetsuits, or the two German acrobats who got married 150 feet above the town square on a double trapeze. Some of my own favorite memories include the night when I discovered that the father of the bride, present to give her away, was at that very moment in the process of divorcing her mother in order to marry the mother of the groom. I don't know how they sorted the relationship out after that, but it happened right here in Wichita, and so far as I know, they have all lived happily ever after. There was the afternoon wedding in the home of a great couple. Many of you know, when I was to unite their daughter to a 6-foot-4-inch Internal Revenue agent from Kansas City, whose craggy Irish face had already made me say to myself, I hope my tax return never gets audited by this guy. He'd scare me to death. Only to have this big, strong man reveal such a tender heart that he broke down in the middle of the ceremony and cried so hard the bride had to make his responses for him. I remember the couple passing through town who presented me with an envelope after the wedding, knowing they'd be out of sight by the time I opened it at home and found the $50 bill in Monopoly money. I think Billy spent it. And the occasional young groom running back across the church parking lot at the last minute, billfold gaping open in his hand to ask, oh, by the way, how much do we owe? A moment so embarrassing that we finally accepted a system that spares everybody from that awkwardness. And I remember, of course, the only wedding of all the hundreds that I almost missed. There was some excuse for me. The couple rehearsed on Thursday night instead of Friday for their Saturday wedding, and like any other creature of habit and confusion, Mr. Scott, when Saturday evening came, my conscious mind had surrendered to the notion that it had all taken place. I had a frantic call from Ruth Kramer, who screamed, "Where are you?" I didn't recognize her voice. I said, "Who is this?" She said, "It's Ruth Kramer, and I have already seated the mothers." That was at Plymouth Church, and I live over by Mays Road. Ruth got up and announced to the audience that the minister had been detained. There were a few giggles from the ones who knew the minister to be somewhat absent-minded. Ann Allen, our organist, delighted the waiting audience with a rousing rendition of "Get Me to the Church on Time." While I raced across town to limit the damage as much as possible. Some members of the family I almost forgot that night are now members of this church. Molly Lavacek is sitting up in the balcony. And I cannot tell you how graciously they handled the whole thing. The photographer knew that I'd be racing across the basement floor of the church and was waiting to snap a picture. And if you'd care to see it and the marvelous comments written on it by that wonderful family, I have propped it up in the meeting room between here and our fellowship hall. It is one of my most treasured mementos. For the peace of mind of any couples who have weddings planned here in the future, I now have what I believe to be a foolproof system, along with a live-in wedding consultant who has an excellent memory. If you have any doubts about how I feel about weddings, I can dispel them. I think they're wonderful. I mean it sincerely when I pray over them one last time at the end, hoping that the years ahead will deepen the joy of their choice and make it lastingly true. I think I'm almost as happy for them as they are for themselves when they go back down the aisle, trippingly to the warm applause of every person in the room who loves them. More than half of them, we are told, will not make it. And they have, for the most part, little notion of the trials yet to come. But then none of us did. All we could hope for was the blessing of the church and those who loved us and the chance to try to make good on the promises we had made. All in all, I spend some of the happiest moments of ministry doing the things I have just described. About 15 of the couples who have been married in this church as non-members now belong to it and are actively involved in its life, a happy consequence I had hoped might take place, but was not sure about. So I thank every one of you who helped to build a church so beautiful that couples keep coming to share in this gorgeous room one of the most joyous times in life. I should think the God of beauty might very well approve.